Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Keith Rathbone. I'm calling you here from Macquarie University. I'm here with Natalie Koch, or Koch, if you are a pronouncer of German, and she is the Associate Professor of Geography at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, and also the editor of a new book from Routledge called Critical Geographies of Sport, Space, Power, and Sport in Global Perspective. Natalie, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
I was really happy that we could get this interview together. Your book, for me, as somebody coming from a sports history background, was fascinating to see maybe a common set of issues and questions related to how governments use sports to promote their own legitimacy, or how people use sports as a way to integrate or not integrate into society, but from the perspective of space, and just with a different set of tools and kind of initial questions. So I wanted to start out by saying this was just a really fascinating set of essays. And I guess I wanted to start by learning a little bit more about you, how you came to study sports, more generally, and then how did you develop this specific book project, this edited volume?
Yeah, thank you. So when I was a student from day one, I went into geography. I was very fortunate to fall into the discipline very early, but many students tend to find geography much later if they end up with an undergraduate degree or a graduate degree in geography. It's a relatively small discipline within the U.S. So when I came to geography as a discipline, I wasn't really aware of the full breadth of it because it is very, very far-reaching in terms of the coverage. And as an undergraduate, I didn't really know that sports geography existed as a subfield. I knew a few corners of the discipline, but as a geography major, it really wasn't on my radar. But I was doing my dissertation research as a graduate student in geography, and my dissertation work was on Astana, Kazakhstan's new capital city. And for anybody who's familiar with the cycling world, is well aware that there has been a cycling team, Team Astana, for many years now. And so because I was using the capital city project as a way to open up bigger questions of politics and identity and geopolitics, how that was all working through the images and the narratives of the capital city. And indeed, it is kind of odd to have a cycling team or any team named for a capital city on, you know, the world tour stage and the international stage. And in addition to that, the team itself was funded by Kazakhstan's Sovereign Wealth Fund. So this struck me as something of something rather perplexing. And when I was in Kazakhstan during one of the Tour de France victories of Alberto Contador, everybody in Kazakhstan was very interested in this particular victory. And even though, you know, Contador is not from Kazakhstan, had almost no attachment to Kazakhstan, he was racing for Team Astana. And people across Kazakhstan kept telling me that Kazakhstan won the Tour de France. And that just struck me as such an odd thing to say. And I really wanted to understand this and to get more into these questions of how it is that you have this confluence of actors and money and people coming from all around the world to create this particular cycling team in the name of the Capital City Project of Kazakhstan, which, you know, at that point in time, people in the West probably mostly encountered through images of Borat, right? And a lot of these images around the sports team and other things that the government has really invested in has been in response to the Borat fiasco, as I kind of think of it there. So I started to do more research on this team and did interviews with people in focus groups to get an understanding of how people were talking about the team and who they understood as being part of it. So this is really what got me first going into the topic of sports, but it was never really anything I thought I would pursue in the in a more substantial way. But I saw very quickly that people were very interested in this topic, and I ended up giving a number of lectures related to this. Students love to engage with sports in classes on geography, and especially when you're talking about things that are quite tricky, like authoritarianism, which is, you know, one of the major topics that I focus on, and other sorts of things about politics and resource economies and how governments that have a lot of resource wealth choose to invest that. You know, as I mentioned, it was the sovereign wealth fund taking Kazakhstan's oil and gas revenues and putting that into a cycling team to pay some Europeans to bring pride to the country on the international stage. Those are kind of unusual patterns to see. So I really have just tried to use that as an entry point to reach students in different audiences. So I, you know, over some time of working on this topic and encountering other people in geography who kind of had a similar experience as me, where they had a really intense, you know, interest in something related to sports. And I should also add, you know, here in this discussion of the cycling team, that I myself am a cyclist. So I was interested in understanding it from that angle as well. So I met a number of people that had their own sort of sporting interest, perhaps, and had been following that as critical geographers, but always on the side. And it was just a little, you know, as we sometimes say, a dessert research project. You do it when you have the time, and it's, you know, it's not something that you can really get your whole sustenance on and make your career on. But it sort of made a lot of the academic hurdles that we have to jump through somewhat more pleasant, and that's certainly been my experience. So I started to find these kindred spirits in geography, and ended up putting together several panel sessions at two geography conferences. I think it was 2014 and 2015. So we had the annual geography meetings, and each of those events, we pulled in people that participated in that into this book for the edited collection. And there, you know, there's some people that we weren't able to include for various reasons. And this kind of comes out in the beginning, where I talk about why it is that geography or sports geography hasn't really been taken very seriously, is that in some cases, or at least in one case in particular, a PhD student had an absolutely fantastic paper, but he was being pressured by his advisor not to contribute to the book because he thought it would hurt him on the job market to have done research on sports. And so he was told explicitly, don't do it. And, you know, I think that was a shame, because he was doing some really, really fascinating, fantastic research, and I wish that we were able to include him. But it also kind of keyed me into this bigger issue within geography as a discipline, and in particular, just this idea that this isn't really really serious work, or that it really can only be a side project. And certainly for younger scholars, they shouldn't be dabbling in this. You know, obviously some people don't really agree with that, myself being in that camp. But nonetheless, it made me realize that in my position as still a young scholar, but now I have tenure, I have the wherewithal to put together this collection and really sort of champion a critical approach to sports geography and say, we don't need to accept this narrative. But younger scholars, especially, you know, graduate students, they're not in a position to push that. That student who was told don't study this or don't publish on this was not necessarily in a position of power to push back against that. So I've really felt that this is something I enjoy doing, but I also think that it's important to, you know, sort of build that sense of community and demonstrate to younger scholars that this work can be serious. And then as that continues to grow, to hopefully advance a critical approach to geography such that you wouldn't have in the future a professor tell his student that this shouldn't be a topic to be published on, but to actually be very supportive and encouraging of that kind of work.
Yeah, I think that that's that tension that maybe many people who work in sports studies can relate to. I think that's probably been a part of many of our lives. I know myself, I had the same kind of, even now I oftentimes get into conversations with myself about whether I should define myself as a French historian interested in sports or as a sports historian in France. Right. So I think we're all kind of and I think your book does a lot to, as you say, advance a kind of more critical, a more critical and rigorous way of examining sport. So for people interested in reading this edited volume, this isn't just a kind of collection that's put together because all these authors are interested in geography and sports. You're also all engaging with what you're calling the practice of critical geography, and you're drawing inspiration from another or earlier scholar, John Bale. So I wonder if you can unpack a little bit what you all mean within the discipline of geography when you talk about critical geography and who John Bale is, and what does studying sports bring to the table when you're engaging in this kind of critical geography? What kinds of different types of questions or maybe different angles on the same questions to sports avail to you?
Yeah, absolutely. The way that I talk about, or I sort of introduce critical geography in the volume and elsewhere in my own research is, you know, there's been a push in many academic circles, not just in geography, but to talk about, critical fill in the blank. And often everybody seems to have a different take on what that means. And there might be some people who see critical research in the social sciences as coming from a particular theoretical angle. You can have post-structuralism or post-colonialism. You might see some people grouping feminist theory into this. Marxist approaches sometimes get looped in here as well. So there's all different range of pulling on these different theoretical camps. I don't think it's very useful to distinguish between those different camps. Rather, what I see as a commonality across what people are kind of subsuming under this critical umbrella is an interest in power. And to me, that's the sort of unifying thread. And I know that that's, you know, obviously all of these different theoretical approaches are going to approach power in a different way, but they nonetheless have an interest in understanding the politics and the power relations that play out in whatever topic they're researching, but then also a kind of reflexivity of the power and the political positioning of the researcher themselves. So trying to bring those perspectives into sports geography, I think, is something that has been the earliest work that you really see is coming from John Vail, as you mentioned, the effort to focus on political relations in this kind of research is quite significant. I think at the early years when he was writing initially back in the early 80s, because geography at that time was very quantitative. And there are still, you know, there's large segments of the discipline that are more interested in modeling and mapping and just using mapping technologies to come up with some statistical answer to a question that they might have. And so you can still see this a couple of years ago at the geography conferences. I'm sure there's probably still people doing this kind of research now where they're just interested in seeing how you can use GIS technologies, geographic information systems technologies, to map like the spectatorship of a particular team, or looking at where college athletes are recruited from, and just using mapping technologies to tell us that information. To me, sports geography or critical sports critical sports geography needs to go one step further, right? It's to ask about the political relations that you are actually mapping, and then also to reflect on your role as a researcher in how you are engaging with these sorts of technologies of mapping and knowing. So not to just leave it there, but to go one step further to look at the power dynamics of research and of whatever it is you're researching. So again, I think in the early days when John Vail was writing on sports geography, geography was still very much focused on this more sort of, you know, quantitative mapping approach to things. And this was, though, at the time, you know, in a number of, across a number of different science, social sciences, people were starting to get more interested in social theory and reading a number of scholars from, you know, in the Foucauldian tradition that I'm mostly rooted in myself, from Foucault's work and others, kind of in that direction, and actor network theory. And this is kind of the late 80s when we start to really see the rise of feminist theory in and across the social sciences. So this starts to come to a number of the social sciences, including geography. And for me, when I say critical theory and critical geography, I'm interested, you know, in that sort of broader shift to think about and to prioritize power in the study of the various topics that we're all interested in. And then from there, I think, you know, we start to see a number of people across the discipline and in their various subfields engaging with this. But for whatever reason, well, actually probably because sports geography is simply small and hadn't really come to its own at that point in time, the critical approach never really took. So John Vail was an absolutely prolific author, put together an astonishing number of, you know, monographs, edited collections, all range of work. But he was, you know, he didn't seem to the field itself didn't seem to necessarily ossify into something too much broader than him and a handful of colleagues within geography. And, you know, he worked across the discipline, you know, across disciplinary lines as well, such that, you know, by the time I came to start doing research on this about probably 7 years ago or so, there still wasn't really a strong sense that sports geography could be something more than it is, even though he had already laid that groundwork, as had a number of others. You know, there's obviously a number of other scholars like Rooney, and a handful, but you know, it just hadn't really ossified into a mainstream approach within sports geography.
So then, in some ways, the larger and in fact, I think it's fair to say the broader goal of this edited volume is not just to illuminate these separate but interconnected questions that all the authors are dealing with, and they do all center around the question of power and power relation, but also to articulate a kind of new approach or more rigorous approach to the study of sport within geography. And then perhaps even more, there's an interesting, almost activist call at the end of your introduction to, or maybe at the end of your conclusion, that gestures towards using these tools in a social justice space. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the one of the major reasons I wanted to keep a broader approach to what critical theory would mean in the volume is that I don't believe in, I mean, I truly do feel like a lot of theoretical frameworks they're built upon a kind of authoritarian ethic. And that is that this is the right approach. And that's really it. So, you know, I don't believe in that. I believe that academia and theoretical frameworks should be pluralistic. And I think that that's really important to allow people the space, students as much as, you know, established scholars, to give people the space to think through the different theoretical tools that might be useful for them. I mean, I will refuse to adhere to any particular theory because I don't think theory is dogma. I think it's a set of tools that you might apply systematically when it's useful. So I think because of my personal commitment to maintaining that pluralism, I wanted to make sure that I gave the authors in the collection the freedom and the space to do that, and to approach that in any number of ways that they might choose. And I think one of the interesting tensions, or the difficult tensions, for many scholars who are interested in social theory, and you know, if they want to call it critical, radical, whatever it is, many many people are deeply committed to social justice and thinking about how their research might be used to, you know, to transform the world for good into something more just. And that's not always an easy question to answer. In fact, it's a very difficult question to answer as academics. So, you know, I think each of the chapters thinks about power in a different way, but often when ending a research study in a country that is not your own, it's very difficult to say, this is what we should do to achieve justice in this particular situation. Not just because of that difference between the researcher and the researched, but also because you know, in a number of cases, a vast majority of cases, in my view, that's really quite ambiguous. So there, you know, how do you necessarily assess what is the right or wrong thing to do in a particular situation? So I think the chapter that I've co-authored as the conclusion together with Dave Jansen is to get people to reflect on what social justice means in how they're approaching it in their work, and to think about the multiple axes of that within sports, you know, sports studies more generally, because there, it's not clear how you set your priorities in this particular case, right? Because the different axes of political divide that we see kind of playing out in the book, there's, you know, things to give the example of Lisa Nelson's chapter on Latinos playing soccer in fields in rural Georgia, and the exclusions that these people feel. It is very much along the Latino-non-Latino divide, but it is also internal to the community in terms of men versus women, and how men and women experience that that act of playing soccer on the weekends with some friends quite differently in that particular context. Then you can look at, you know, just taking one example of environmental issues and the environmental impact of sport. That is another completely different way of thinking about what social justice and equality means than necessarily just the focus on race or migration status of your documentation versus gender. The environmental implications, yes, they often have connections to those axes, but nonetheless, the kinds of problems that you would be focusing on if you took that lens are going to be somewhat different, right? So what we're hoping to do in the conclusion is just to open that up a bit more and to say, you know, we have all these different axes of difference, but to kind of leave it somewhat open in terms of how people are comfortable engaging with those different issues. One thing I always tell my students and pretty much anybody who will listen. So one of my favorite quotes from the French theorist Michel Foucault, he talks about politics as a kind of aesthetics, right? And for Foucault, his personal political interests were related to prison reform. I mean, that's just one of his handful of issues that he was particularly interested in. But he saw this as, you know, a personal inclination to address this, and he was very passionate about this. But he understood that many people didn't necessarily share that passion, and that their passion might lie somewhere else. And that is, you know, and that's why he kind of frames it as a kind of aesthetics. How you personally are positioned and your own preferences and your own abilities and your own skill set are going to come into how you are thinking about what issues are important for you to address if you're interested in these social justice questions or these questions of power and politics. Because again, when you're thinking in a broader sense, and especially as I do work in authoritarian contexts, opposition and resistance and social change doesn't happen through the same channels that we, you know, sort of have this essentialist liberal understanding of opposition and resistance and change through free speech and demonstration and protest and elections and all those sorts of things. What if those are closed down to you? How do you make change? What sort of ways do people find into the system to challenge those power relationships or alter those power relationships or at least benefit from those power relationships? None of that is really is really clear from many of the a great deal of the research on liberal context. So again, here just trying to open it up to say there are broader ways of thinking about social justice that we hope, you know, including chapters from liberal democracies and authoritarian states, can help shine a little bit of light on that.
Yeah, I think readers should know, listeners should know, just how diverse the range of essays you can find in this edited volume. I mean, people addressing questions of stadium construction and deconstruction in Seoul, the several articles related to the integration of immigrants in different places. In the United States and Georgia, for example, as you mentioned, but also in Ireland, professional wrestling in territory, which was particularly interesting to me, as well as a series of articles that relate to authoritarian regimes. And you've divided this up in your volume into the first half of the book dealing with sports and state spaces, and then the second half dealing with sports and community and urban spaces. Your contribution is in the first part of the book, and you're looking at athletic autocrats and unpacking in some ways how autocrats use athleticism in particular ways. So I wonder if you can talk us through your own work in the volume for a minute. How did you come to this project, and what do we need to know about autocratic sportsmen?
Yeah, I mean, I've because I work in the post-Soviet world, or have worked there for so many years, I've obviously seen all of the images of Vladimir Putin doing different
shirtless
sports.
Riding horses,
and yeah, exactly, judo is what he, you know, where he really got his start, but since becoming president of Russia, then he's all of a sudden doing all these other sports, and there are these very coordinated photo ops, right? So it's really quite impressive to see the array of these images. But it's not just Putin, number one. So I noticed this certainly because I work primarily in Central Asia, and in Kazakhstan and in Turkmenistan, the president is constantly photographed doing sports as well. So I had started to do research on this some years before I actually ended up writing this chapter. And it, you know, there's actually a number of cases in non-authoritarian contexts where you have the leaders being photographed doing sports. So there's kind of you know, this whole thing in and around one of the Clinton-Gore election campaigns where they're doing sports together. And there's always a commentary in the United States media about the leaders' athleticism or lack of athleticism in some cases, right? So anyways, this is a common thing. And I noticed as well, as I started to do more research on this, that Putin wasn't the only one in history to have been photographed shirtless doing sports, but that in fact Mussolini was perhaps the first one to do this. And there was tons of pictures of Mussolini shirtless. Skiing was the most famous one, but he's doing all sorts of other things shirtless. So, you know, this got me thinking about the sort of cultural divides and differences of these leaders doing sports. So as I mentioned, because I'm a scholar with authoritarianism, I was most interested in explaining this in authoritarian contexts. And so what I wanted to do in the chapter that I wrote on athletic autocrats is simply to ask, why does this happen? What is the reason for this? And why do we see this across so many countries and across history. Like, this is not an isolated phenomenon. So what I decided to do in the end was to choose three different autocratic leaders and to think about how they had been portrayed as sportsmen. And I should note here, I did not find any.
Yeah,
women
I wanted
that
to
would
ask you about that actually.
The way I sort of come to it is maybe a facile explanation, but there simply aren't many women autocrats that are heads of state. So you could certainly find a few women that might classify as such, but I didn't find any that were actually being portrayed as doing athletics. And, you know, there's all sorts of cultural reasons for that. And that is, in fact, where I wanted to go with this chapter, is to think about the gender performance of these pictures, right? Portraying the leader as an athlete. There's a certain construction of masculinity that happens through these photographs and through their circulation in the in the political community where they're grounded. So I wanted to think then also and contribute to some of the research and, you know, various interdisciplinary discussions about gender and identity. And there's a strong direction of this in sports studies as well, thinking about the body and the gendered experiences of sport. But here, thinking or focusing more on masculinity, right? Because I think that's, you know, in gender studies overall, I simply think that's, there's a lot more that needs to be said about that, especially in authoritarian regimes. So how do we then see different cultural understandings and constructions of masculinity coming out through these photographs? So I focus on, for this particular chapter, I focus on Vladimir Putin, Chairman Mao in China, who was portrayed as a swimmer. And in the third case is Sheikh Zayed, who is known as the founding father of the Emirates of the UAE, which is another country where I also do research. So I just wanted to think about, you know, I didn't want to make any overgeneralizations about how masculinity works through these pictures, but to actually try and ground that in some specific cases. So there's a different kind of performance of the masculine ideal and the leader as having this particular strong hand, or just being particularly virile in the case of Putin, right? That comes out and gets portrayed through these images. And there's a different kind of masculinity than when you're looking at somebody like Sheikh Zayed, who in terms of sports is primarily framed as a lover of falconry, or a number of the other leaders, the current leaders in the UAE, as lovers of equestrian sport. So there are different constructions of the images around the care of the animal and the sort of paternalism that is being displayed there versus, you know, Putin going out in the, you know, rough countryside of Russia and connecting with the land in that way. There's also a different construction of the homeland in the Arabian Peninsula, where the falconry and the horse racing or in camel racing and other sort of heritage, quote unquote, heritage sports that are playing out in the desert and that sort of landscape. So it's the construction of masculinity in and through these landscapes as well that is what I'm sort of getting to in this particular approach. And I think to come back to one of your earlier questions about the special focus on space and place of geography allows us to really pull apart some of those geographic differences and to point to how different the cult of personality around Putin is from Mao, from Idi Amin, from Sheikh Zayed to Mussolini, right? we might talk about it as if it's a uniform phenomenon, but really you have to understand the political geography, the cultural geography, all those sort of social elements coming together to help understand why these autocrats use sports and images of sports in the way that they do.
Yeah, this chapter in particular, and I'm not just saying that because we're talking, but I'm also interested in the way in which authoritarian regimes use sports and the ways in which autocrats use sports. But I loved the kind of different tensions we could see when you pull these three autocrats together, especially Sheikh Zayed, who I was not as familiar with. This kind of discourse around him, and it's a very different, as you suggest, discourse of masculinity that seems focused not only on these heritage games and very much in line with the specific desert dwelling communities of the Emirates, but also seems to focus on a kind of mastery, you know, that's very different from the kind of almost virile, you know, judo shirtless of Putin. And so there may be different models of what at times you refer to as their superhuman nature, their superhumanity. But at the same time, they also Putin maybe more than Sheikh Zayed has to portray himself as almost. I've been in Australia too long. I wanted to use the word blokish, like an ordinary sports, somebody ordinarily interested in sports and not just doing this because he needs to have a political image, but also to be an authentically sporty person, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I mean, I think that comes back to the various cultural and social and political differences in a place like Russia versus the UAE. So there's each of these men is working within a different they're circulating with different groups, right? So when we talk about something like the cult of personality or this idea of a cult of personality, one of the biggest challenges of even just that frame, the cult, there's a strong thread of Orientalism that gets woven in there, right? But overall, the falseness of this construction of the dear leader as superhuman is that the dear leader as a singular entity exists as such. And rather than, you know, acknowledging that Putin is only powerful because, well, he has a whole network of people that are constantly kowtowing and doing everything in their power to please him. But they're also very much interested in maintaining that idea that Putin does everything, because that means that then they can advance themselves in a way that deflects attention from certain political relations that they have. And so this is what you certainly saw with the case of Stalin and Hitler and others. They had a wide network of elites who were in that inner circle, who were very interested in maintaining that myth of the central leader, because they were able to skirt around criticism themselves, right? Because it was just the leader does X, and then it's this disjuncture between the implementation, but the leader is pure and his intentions are good. So this is a common sort of thing that you have playing out, but nonetheless, somebody like Putin, he has to maintain his position of power, in my opinion, as an observer of Russian politics over many years. He has to maintain that position at the center, because he's really his entire livelihood and existence is built upon maintaining his place in these networks around him. So with the case of the UAE, it's a rather different kind of configuration than post-Soviet Russia, where there is much more, I would say a broader sort of consultative culture that is how politics works. And that then plays out in the way that people exert their influence and demonstrate their masculinity and demonstrate their prowess and their ability to be a good leader. So being able to demonstrate that you are a consultative person with the elites is something that you're going to see as prioritized. So one of the things, and I do research on falconry. I've continued to do for many years now, probably like 5 years now, research on falconry in the Gulf states and looking at the connections also in Central Asia. But what the space of the camp is really important in understanding falconry and why it is seen as a sport that that these groups of men go and they do together, and they're deciding many important political decisions at the camp, around the campfire, and that sort of social experience of that is really important. And in a similar fashion as I think maybe for the reference for Americans or Brits, perhaps would be golf, right? A lot of these, the social networks and connections happen through not really the playing of golf, right? Who really cares what your score was at the end of the day? But it's that venue for materializing these really important power relations. So, you know, I think in the case of the UAE and falconry, there's a similar kind of dynamic for some of these elites who are engaging in the sport and continues today.
I'd like to turn a little bit to some of the other authors' work and to come back to what you were saying about the particular ways in which sports are being mobilized in the post-Soviet sphere. Two of your co-authors, Slavomir Horik, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing any names, Veli-Pekka Tinkinen, that's I'm sure mispronounced, both worked on sport in the post-Soviet sphere. I wonder if there's something maybe particular about the way in which authoritarian governments, companies, cities are working together in these post-Soviet spaces to use sports in new ways, or are we just seeing maybe reflections of what's already been done in new places?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so To me, there's certainly been a longstanding aspiration across the post-Soviet space to host these major sporting events, what I refer to as sort of first-tier sporting events. But because of the various political difficulties in a number of the countries across the region, they're really only ending up with second tier events. And that's an example of what Slavomir is looking at in his chapter on Turkmenistan's Asian Games in 2017. And what you should note about the Asian Games in 2017 is it's not really the full proper Asian Games. It was just the indoor martial arts games. So just a little segment of that. And Slavomir's chapter talks a bit about this, and I've also written another article elsewhere with a colleague from Azerbaijan, Anar Valiyev, on exactly this topic of how it is that these particular countries end up hosting all these second-tier events like the Asian Games. You know, Kazakhstan has hosted that as well. Azerbaijan hosted the European Games a couple of years ago. And what you see common across these particular countries, and the ones, you know, I'll first talk about the Central Asian cases, and I'll come back to Russia, which is what Veli-Pekka's article is about, or chapter is about. These these countries are all, so Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, they all have pretty substantial oil and gas resources. And the way that they're, that the governments have, you know, sort of formed in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91 has very much been tied to developing those resources and in investing them in major infrastructure projects. And the infrastructure projects, yes, they do materialize certain things, like big stadiums and new capital cities, amongst other sorts of iconic architecture and big expensive projects. But what this sets in motion is the possibility to use state money, money from the sovereign wealth fund, from the administration, central budget, to fund these projects, infrastructure, like stadium, whatever it is. So they're taking state money and putting that to these projects. By and large, I mean, across the region, it is, it's pretty endemic, is that these are, I just will be blunt, big money laundering schemes. So if you look at the construction companies that are building these various projects, they're almost all headquartered. Well, they are all headquartered offshore. Offshore being, you know, just in another country from the country where the projects are being built. So the big construction companies are overpaid for what they are building, and are then able to get that money offshore and into personal bank accounts via, you know, all sorts of convoluted processes, which we probably know the most about in the case of Azerbaijan, courtesy of the Panama Papers. But you know, there's fortunately been quite a bit of recent, you know, information that has been given about these schemes. Nonetheless, the sporting events really allow this to happen because it gives a justification for putting more and more money into these iconic projects. So to come back to the case of Turkmenistan and what Slavomir's chapter is focusing on, the government of Turkmenistan put billions of dollars into building this Olympic Park area. And ostensibly, you know, this is because, well, they need the sporting facilities for this Asian Games in 2017. There was absolutely no need for the kind of facilities and the kind of money that they put into this. But nonetheless, it was used as a justification for this kind of development and to push that forward. So this is something that you see elsewhere in the region. And in Russia, it's a similar dynamic, although rather more diffuse. So I think one of the interesting things about the World Cup in 2018, so last year, was that all of a sudden you had these kind of investments getting spread across Russia. Whereas when you had the Olympics in Sochi, much of that investment and the companies and the people that were benefiting directly from the sort of state largesse were rather concentrated. So sometimes, you know, the physical geography of the country really matters and is significant to understanding how these revenues get distributed and patronage gets distributed through the country and through the different political networks. You know, such a, you know, you have something more diffuse in Russia versus Turkmenistan versus Kazakhstan. I think one thing, though, that we really wanted to do across the collection is to bring in perspectives that weren't just focused on the Olympics or focused on the major mega events, right? Because to the extent that geographers have done work on this, you know, on sports in recent years, it is almost exclusively located in the realm of mega events. So what I wanted to do in putting together this collection was to make sure that we didn't just reproduce one of those volumes, because there are many now. And so I was very happy. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I actually saw some interesting parallels between Slavomir's articles and then articles in the later section written by Jung Woo Lee and Michael Friedman talking about stadium in Seoul, and then the construction of mall parks in the United States. For me, it was fascinating to consider the ways in which some of the more critical lens that we could apply to projects that we see in sort of the post-Soviet space or generally within the global South, when we turn a similar critical lens at our construction projects in the United States or in South Korea, or I'm sure across much of the world, it doesn't look so different, does it?
Absolutely. Well, and that's always a point that I make when I give lectures on, you know, in the last year, I did a lot of public lectures on the World Cup in Russia, and will probably, because I'm sitting now in Doha, Qatar, which was hosting the 2022 games. So I've been working in the Gulf for quite a long time, but whenever I speak on this topic at lectures or speaking with students, I constantly come back to the way that we see a lot of the same dynamics playing out in ostensibly Western liberal democratic contexts. So with the example of the London Games, you had evictions in and around the stadia and East End. You saw a lot of very authoritarian practices playing out on the ground in Rio with favela relocations and other sorts of dynamics. And you also obviously have the big example of the Montreal Games in Canada. The city was only able to pay off its debt from the Olympic Stadium. I think it was in 2013 or something, right? Massive corruption scandal around that. And those things are often forgotten. And so whenever I present about these authoritarian countries where I do research, I do try to come back to that particular point. But I think the broader challenge then is how we see sporting bodies facilitating or pushing back against that as a possibility, right? So what we see in terms of the behavior and the decisions of FIFA and the IOC in recent years is, you know, they seem to be pretty on board with this, and they're happy to profit from that, right? So when the media is just kind of demonizing these authoritarian places and critiquing their human rights abuses, et cetera, to my mind, we need to be talking about who are the actors that are facilitating this, because I can guarantee you there's a lot of complicity from Western construction companies, from various consulting companies, energy and power suppliers, all range of suppliers that are interested in this, just as much as there is, you know, then the institutional frameworks like people in FIFA and the IOC who are facilitating this. So I, you know, obviously we should be worried about these other human rights issues, but I think that if that so dominates the coverage of these major sporting events and what have you, that we fail to look back on what and who is actually promoting that from ostensibly democratic context, we don't really get anywhere. So that's sort of something I've been interested in thinking about for some time now, but I appreciate the point of making that connection. And I think, you know, generally, our chapter on Korea's Dongdaemun Stadium is really fantastic, because he traces this in terms of the history as well, and shows us how the vision and the ideas about the baseball stadium in Korea have changed so dramatically over decades, and how that plays out in municipal politics, and how the municipal politics are also shifting as we see the understanding of the stadium coming to the end, or the eventuality of being demolished and replaced with a design plaza, and then the stadium itself being relocated on the outskirts of the city in a completely different, you know, style and type of stadium, which is all to say, you know, there's a longer life to a lot of these projects than the very narrow temporal focus that we often end up with when we just focus on the mega events. But I did want to just quickly come back to Veli Pekka's chapter on Russia, because I think there's also a point about the spatial diffusion of a number of these initiatives and how authoritarian governments, but other governments as well, they have, or sporting events and sporting programs have a much broader spatial extent than is often really acknowledged. And I think Veli Pekka's article, a chapter showing how Gazprom, the Russian gas company, uses sports in a way to kind of, you know, he talks about it in terms of capillary power to extend its reach into all these various corners across Russian territory and to bring that to life across space. So I think we can think about the different times and the different spaces of sport in a much more productive manner if we get beyond the sort of spectacle of the mega event, right? Because the power of the spectacle is to pull your attention to what's at the center and its more immediate, more centralized temporality and spatiality. But what I think a lot of the chapters do very well is to show that there's something much more diffuse. And if we just train our eye on what is more diffuse, we might have a different understanding of how power is working in these different spaces and times.
Well, great. And with that, I guess I'd like to pose our last question, which is, Natalie, what are you working on now? What can we look forward to hearing about soon?
So I am working on a handful of projects. As I mentioned, I'm still doing research on falconry. This is one aspect of the research I've been doing in the Gulf countries, is looking at heritage sports. And here again, trying to shift beyond just thinking about the mega events in the area, although there are quite a few large sporting events being hosted in the Gulf countries, and Qatar and the UAE is where I have been focusing my research in the last years. So I first started to go to travel to Doha, which I mentioned is where I am at the moment, back in 2012. So since then, you know, and by the time World Cup arrives in 2022, I will have been watching the city transform and get ready for the games for a period of about 10 years. So it has been, you know, kind of a longer term approach to just watching and observing what is playing out in the region. I've also been I've been working on some research in the last several weeks, and you know, paying attention to this somewhat before, looking at Gulf sponsorship of international sporting teams, and probably, you know, what people know best is probably the Emirates and all of the European football clubs and other clubs around the world, in fact, that they sponsor with the big Fly Emirates logo. But there's also Etihad and Qatar Airways. So I'm looking at those three airlines, as well as several of the elites who are from the Emirates and from Qatar, who own various teams in the area. So, yeah. Exactly. So Sheikh Mansour of the Emirates, who owns Manchester City. There's also Sheikh Nasser bin Hamad Al Khalifa, who is behind the new cycling team Bahrain Merida. Emirates also sponsors a cycling team now as well. So I'm looking at, you know, the role of these Gulf individuals, companies, sovereign wealth funds, and others who are putting money into international sports? And there again, kind of asking a similar set of questions as mentioned before of how and why are they doing this? Because I don't think it's as simple as what a lot of people say. You know, it's just the Gulf countries trying to promote a positive image on the international stage. Okay, sure, there's a piece of that. But if you look at the Emirati and the Qatari elites who are sponsoring this, they also identify as athletes and it's a particular interest of them. But they're also pulling sovereign wealth fund money into these projects. And it is very much seen as a particular kind of investment. And in some cases, they're okay with losing certain royal wealth. But in other cases, when you've got the sovereign wealth fund and the big airlines involved, they are very much after certain profits. So I'm trying to there again just tell a more diffuse story about why we see the rise of Gulf sports sponsorship, especially after 2008, when we saw the financial crash or the global financial crisis, as well as in 2009, the financial fair play regulations coming into or being adopted in UEFA, such that European football teams were not to be losing money, lest they be sanctioned. So this, you know, sort of confluence events and interests as what has been behind a lot of this. So that's just a handful of the things that I'm working on. But obviously, looking at the developments in Doha and seeing all of the stadiums going up around the city, it's significant even. You know, it was already a World Cup under the international eye, but now that Qatar is under blockade and has been since June 2017 from its neighbors, the politics of the blockade has absolutely been playing out through sports and Qatar's winning of the Asia Cup in Abu Dhabi when I was there a couple of weeks ago was quite dramatic. You know, there's a number of things that are really fascinating to watch in terms of how these politics in the GCC region, you know, the world at large play out through these major sporting events, but also then, you know, and just the corporate sponsorships like Emirates sponsoring PSG and that deal ending because, well, it is a team owned by a Qatari businessman. So, you know, these are the general things that I think is so powerful about sport is being able to look at, as I mentioned before, something very tricky and politically difficult, but through something that's a little bit more familiar and easier to understand for many of us who are interested in the sporting world.
Thank you so much again, Natalie, for joining us. This has been Keith Rathbone. I'm speaking today with Natalie Cook, Associate Professor of Geography at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University and the editor of a really fascinating edited volume that you all should check out from Routledge called Critical Geographies of Sport, Space, Power, and Sport in Global Perspectives. Thank you all very much for listening to New Books in Sports. Thank you, Natalie, for joining us. That's goodbye for me.
Thank you. Bye.